Hello, my name's Tamsin Westhorpe and welcome to Fresh from the Pod Gardening Stories. Now this story is dramatic. I'm talking to plant hunter Tom Hart Dyke, who headed off into the Colombian jungle with his companion Paul Winder in the year 2000. They were kidnapped, they were held for 9 months, and they were given up for dead. So obviously, I'm going to want to discover what that ordeal entailed for Tom and Paul. I also talked to Tom about the world garden at Lullingstone Castle in Kent that he's created at his family home. Both of us run gardens, open gardens, as a business, so I'm keen to know how he's getting on this year. Tom, I am so thrilled to welcome you to Fresh from the Pod. I've known of you and your adventures for many years, and I need to come and see you. So I'm going to put my hands up and say I have not been to your garden, which I'm very ashamed of. Although I've got a million questions for you, obviously about your kidnapping 20 years ago and all those exciting things, what I really wanted to start talking to you about was what we have in common is that we're both crazy gardeners trying to make a living and a business out of running an open garden. I watched the programme Saving Lullingstone Castle in 2006. How's life since then? How's it going?
It's going well, Tamsin. First of all, terrible you haven't been to Lullingstone.
I know.
Terrible behaviour.
They don't let me out of Herefordshire. What can I say?
Exactly. And yourself running a place, I mean, you can't leave the walled area or whatever area you've got, can you? Because there's always something to do. And people don't realise, I mean, at Lullingstone, we're not some of the big boys and girls, but we're a reasonably sized place. Got about 140 odd acres, whether it's the lake, the river, fields, farmers' fields and the like, and the 2 acre walled area that houses the World Garden. We are virtually entirely run, people are amazed to hear, on volunteers. Without a volunteer system, which this nation we're so great at volunteering, the place would fall apart, Tamsin. We're entirely relying on volunteers. There is a guy that comes to cut the lawn and do the edges once a week, most of the year. And we have occasional help with, say, a specialist job like putting up a polytunnel or a special bit of metalwork or woodwork, a carpenter that no one else can do and do properly. But basically, the team at Lullingstone, of which we are 12, almost everybody is a volunteer. And there's not even expenses paid to make the place work. And amazingly, it shouldn't do on paperwork at all, but it amazingly does. But the image of the place like this, people immediately assume, and you've got the word castle in your address, oh my goodness, they must have gold bars in some safe somewhere, or go on their Caribbean holidays to an island that they imagine. I've never been to the Caribbean and we haven't got gold bars. So it really is get your hands dirty, blood, sweat and tears and get on with it. And I love it.
Yeah, it was funny. A garden writer visited me the other day and just was in hysterical laughter because he saw the real me. I was covered in compost. I was serving customers. I was potting on. He was like, oh my goodness. I won't take a photograph of you, he said, because I obviously looked that awful. Looking at your website, it made me chuckle because I saw things that I've got on mine. You know, the credit card machine might not work on every day. It's changed, hasn't it? So don't you think that open gardens are, the expectations are higher? Do you think they are from the customer?
You're absolutely right. And especially in the last couple of years, it really has gone through the roof expectation. And we only had a card machine 4.5 years ago. I mean, we've never had one before. I just think about how we actually survive without them. And they went on the blink over Easter. Such a great Easter visitors. Bless everyone's patience, queuing for a while and in the wind and everything else. But I think with COVID recently, people have been so much more patient and so much more just want to get out and see places and appreciate what's on their doorstep. So it went smoothly. But I think the private places are few and far between, as you're well aware, and there are very few of us left, very few of us left throughout the land. And people just love the quirks of it all. I mean, you can take so much and it gets embarrassing if things don't work or whatever. But people do put up with quite a few quirky things. They appreciate, they know here it's, and if they don't know, they do after they've left. It's me, mum, few volunteers, a small team helping out. I think the biggest thing, and you're absolutely right, expectations have really gone through the roof the last few years. It is the catering. And yes, the garden's important, but it's a tea and a pee, to be blunt. It is that. Even if you're a keen professional gardening outfit coming on a group coach or cars coming to visit us, it is a tea and a pee before you've sort of started. And the garden is sort of an afterthought, which I, perhaps you will as well, won't agree necessarily with that. You want to get in the garden, see the plants, but people do want a sandwich. They do want a bit of homemade cake, a scone with the cream on it and so on. And that's what we do provide in our simple way, but we do provide that. And in the last few years, we've really think we've, the best we can, stepped up to the horticultural plate in our own way. But people love it, Tamsin, the quirks. They love to see, like yourself, covered in compost as the owner. And they do think so. Tom, you know, when we're not here, you know, who helps? Well, there is help, but it's me. They cannot get up. Best friends I've known for 20 years can't get their head around that after, when the sun goes down, 100 staff come out and do it all for me. They really still think that. And I think it's a real mindset. It's a great challenge to try and overturn that mindset.
I mean, the end of my day is doing the loos, emptying all the bins. But I mean, I'm not worried about that, because it is, like you say, it's a family thing. It's hands-on. And that's what makes it so special, is that, like, you are involved with every square inch of it, aren't you?
It's hands-on. Cleaning the toilets, I'm glad I do, strangely rewarding. And I've now got masks on, visors, gloves and hand sanitizers everywhere. And we've really adapted really well, especially the last year, obviously. We've had to survive. Otherwise, you don't survive. You have to adapt to survive. And as you know, it comes down to just a basic couple of people to turn it around, especially recently. And I think we're so pleased with ourselves that we've managed to. We're having fantastic weekends of visitors, even though the house, the church here is closed. And for the year, I think year two of being closed. But the gardens and grounds have saved the entire estate. I mean, Tamsin, we moved here in 1361. You know, those hundreds of years ago, and it was so close to the edge last year. I mean, literally the edge of a cliff, honestly. And just being outside and developing the World Garden and the grounds that have gone with it have saved the entire place. No exaggeration.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't open last year, and what I felt was, gosh, if we didn't open to the public, would we bother? Would we put the effort in? So how did you find not opening? Because you weren't open all year, were you, last year?
You're right. So we do 7 months, April to the end of October. And the first 3 months we weren't open. And by about day three of not opening, Easter, basically, April last year, I was in tears. Yeah. And it wasn't the finances. It wasn't the people not helping out in the garden, which, of course, I needed. But I had so much time to myself to compensate for that. It was, and it really shivers down my spine even talking about it to you now, it was sharing the plants with visitors. It was a huge hole in my life. And it's amazing, until something's gone, you don't realise. I was in tears. It was so amazing. And that's obviously really drummed home that point of why we do it. Yes, to keep the place going financially. Yes, you've got people helping out and all the things that go, the team behind you and the team effort and the team bonding that it is. But it is sharing with people that come to see the garden. And that's a huge part of it. And I didn't realise how much I missed it when it wasn't there. And what was so eerie about last spring, early summer, what fantastic weather we had.
I know.
For most of the, there wasn't a cloud for most of the UK, including northwestern Scotland, not a cloud in the sky for most of April. And I was thinking, the visitors, you know, sharing it. And the coaches, 61 coaches pulled out in 12 hours when Boris on the 23rd of March said, stay at home. And we're just not used to it. Wow. Okay. And they're all coming next year and it will be fine. But the sharing it, to answer your question, a long way around it, but to answer your question, it was sharing with visitors was the biggest hit for me.
Yeah. So you need the garden as much as they need the garden. But what I wanted to ask you is, you know, I was thinking, this morning. If you hadn't been kidnapped in Colombia, would your home, would your estate be in serious danger? I know that sounds ridiculous, but I believe that a garden needs a personality behind it and a story. And do you think, in a strange way, you've saved the place because of that experience?
Yes, I've never been directly asked it in that way. And it really drums home that the fact, yes, is the answer. What would I have done? People say, well, if you didn't go to Colombia and make that silly mistake of crossing the Darien Gap and get kidnapped, and it's how the garden started, as you say, what would I be doing? Well, I mean, I like to think it'd be something to do with the world of plants. But I have to say, yes, it would be in serious peril. The garden has quite literally saved the day, and not instantly either, Tamsin. As you know, it's an evolution, a garden. It's a growing, literally, process. So we started it from scratch 15 years ago in 05, 2006. It wasn't until 2013, 14 that there was a depth of maturity to the garden, whether it was the trees, shrubs, the climbers, or indeed the herbaceous perennials and alpines. And it was only then that the income really started to come in. So we had approaching a decade really of the garden just developing, and there were visitors, the TV programs you alluded to, that helped, but it really was that maturity in the last 4 or 5 years that it's really what I believed in the depths of despair 21 years ago when we thought we were going to end our lives, our captors, and I started drawing the garden. I believe from that second when he told me, you've got 5 hours before we shoot you both, me and my friend I was with, I believed that this garden would work in my head. And initially it was a way of distracting myself throughout captivity, but to put it onto terra firma, I believed it would work. And in the last 4 or 5 years, the weather aside, I mean, we've been so pleased that it is literally funding the place. And Tamsin, now especially, because all the buildings are closed. There's no house, there's no church, yeah, etc. So it's absolutely magnified your question, because it is in every sense keeping the place afloat with everything else closed. And oh, the buzz of that, it's just tingles down my spine with excitement.
Yeah, so it is the saviour of the day. So for those people that haven't been, I mean, I've obviously been loving all the images I've seen of it over the years developing. Just tell us what to expect, because it's so different, isn't it?
It is. And I think it was important to be slightly different. I mean, the walled area itself, which is a 2-acre, 18th century, most of the walls and slightly previous to walled area that's encapsulated by the walls itself, is laid out at 1 acre of it as a miniature map of the world. We've got North America, South America, Africa, Europe, Asia, including the UK and Ireland, and parts of Australasia with Tasmania and North and South Island, New Zealand represented in their actual shapes as a mini map of the world. The actual delineation of the shapes are using rocks from those regions, albeit sourced in the UK. They are actually using rocks as your coastlines, if you like, for each of the areas, as good as we can, depicted from the Oxford Atlas, as good as we can, getting the shapes for the one acre and planting in those specific areas the plants from that particular region, and quite specifically so as well. So in South Island, New Zealand, on the east, west, north and south bit of South Island, New Zealand, are the plants that come from those various areas. And it's to celebrate plant hunters. It's to celebrate these amazing chaps and ladies who went all over the world, especially during that Victorian Edwardian era, to bring back, what's the stats? Something like 85% on average of what you see in your garden, your allotment, your windowsill isn't from this country at all. It's amazing.
Incredible.
It's astonishing what's being introduced. Yeah, and the world is in your allotment. The world is in your garden. The world is on your windowsill. You've probably got 4 or 5 continents represented in a few houseplants. And people have died, or nearly died, trying to bring back yucca elephantipes from Guatemala, the tree yucca. It's just a houseplant you see all over the place. But the stories that are behind the plant, so that's what we try to represent. It is done quirkily. We've got a few flags flying in different continents. We've got a crushed granite pathway instead of the oceans. And we've got a few quirky sculptures. We've got a cobra in India, wooden cobra, and a metal baobab tree, 10-foot tall baobab tree in Africa. And it's just having fun. I think for me, educating people, yes, and so on is really important. But having fun with the garden yourself, because if you're having fun, that comes across in what you do. And when you give a tour of the garden, the first today in a year and a half, first tour this morning, it comes across and therefore enthuses people as well.
Do you find that everybody wants you there? You know, so if you visit Lullingston, they want to see Tom. Is that quite a pressure?
You must find this too. Yes, I think there is that element of it. And only recently, Mum's been saying, when she does the bookings or whatever it is, groups that want to come, Tom may or may not be. We've got a guy who cuts the lawns. He's fantastic, Rob, sort of right-hand man, if you like. He will fill in with a few groups. So Mum does now put that in to say. And most people who don't necessarily live locally or know the story, who are a group of from a WI to a local horticultural group, are fine with that if it's explained. But there are some long faces if I've had to suddenly go off and or I've forgotten something or gone to do something else or whatever, and they have somebody else there. Yes, there is that pressure. I think people have been much more understanding of late, certainly. But yes, certainly, I think some people think, oh gosh, where's he gone? You know, we want Tom to show us around. But as long as you've got an enthusiast who knows his or her stuff to replace you for the day or whatever, then it's absolutely fine. Tamsin, what I should say, actually, the second acre of the walled area, so you've got the World Garden for the first as you come through the 18th century moon gate. The second acre has some interesting polytunnel structures and a small nursery, and that's where we've got some 3,000 different varieties of plant in certain areas of the tunnel. We've got an orchid house, which is semi-tropical, wow. A cactus house, so quite xerophytic, quite deserty, and then we have a couple of warm and temperate houses, so to mimic, well, I suppose they climb into a bit like Tresco, the Abbey Gardens, their experience in the West Country. So just a selection of plants that is totalling now 16 years from scratch, pretty much, for the garden, mostly from seed. We're looking at about 8,000 or so cultivars, species and hybrids. As gosh. I say, the garden's been built on goodwill. Goodwill, yeah. Really. So many donations of plants. I mean, isn't our industry so brilliant? Oh, the chips are down.
Amazing.
People are there to help.
Yeah, and actually some of our customers, someone brought me a box of plants the other day. And you think, what's this for? They said, well, I just thought you might like them. You think, oh, this is just fantastic, isn't it? It is a really great industry to be in, there's no denying. So I picked up your book the other day, The Cloud Garden, and looked at the cover. This is what you wrote when you returned, and I thought, my son is 15. I'm not saying you looked 15 on the cover, but I thought, these are young guys. What the hell were you thinking? You know, as a mum, I just think, you look so young. Tell me what was going through your mind when you decided to trek off in search of plants.
Tamsin, you're being so polite. People are far ruder. Me and Paul are a pair of idiots, let's be honest. I'm trying to be as polite as possible. At the time, I was like 24, Paul a couple of years older. My mum she was so brilliant when we got back, not to sort of slap me really hard. At the time, we thought nothing of it. I was spurred on by my passion for orchids, and it was Granny. I'm not blaming Granny by any means, but she really inspired me in the world of plants. She was absolutely amazing. At the age of 3, she gave me a packet of carrot seeds and a trowel, and that was it. And orchids led on from there after seeing some native bee orchids on our local golf course. And I was just, it's a mystical place, the Darien Gap. If you're not familiar with it, it's in Central America on the Panamanian-Colombian border, and is halfway house, really, for the Pan-American Highway, which starts in Alaska and goes down to Chile, a continuous strip of tarmac for 17,500 miles, except on this rainforest border. There are no roads. The Darien Gap, it's about 90 kilometres width. You've got to walk. And it was a challenge of doing it because it was quite dangerous as well. There was a dangerous element to it, topographically challenging, but politically. But for me, the motivation, the absolutely electromagnetic motivation, was to name a new species of orchid after dear Granny. That was my initial idea, and to see lots of species of orchid. Paul, we're more of a mountaineer at heart, the guy I was with, Paul Winder. So he was there to climb a few hills and mountains, and we climbed so many of them. It was supposed to be a 2-week walk. Oh, dear Tamsin. 2-week walk became nearly 10 months in captivity. And obviously not recommending it, but after being kidnapped, we saw some fantastic orchids. They took us right up into the cloud forests.
Do you know, looking at your, you know, your personality is so positive. I mean, thankfully, I'm sure that helped get you through. I really think you should have called your book The Cloud Garden. You should have called it I Blame Granny. You know, it just sounds. But so when you were captured and you say you saw orchids afterwards, were they constantly moving you?
Were you being moved?
Yeah, absolutely. It was a nomadic lifestyle, Tamsin. I mean, a lot of it was, they said, was for security reasons. There was some paramilitary in the area and we were just being moved from camp to camp. I should explain, over the 9-10 months that we were held, we were looking about 700 different individuals in this group. A third of them were girls, boys. A third of them were girls, young women, and two-thirds boys, young chaps. Now you're saying, boys, girls, what are you on about? A lot of them were holding guns that were twice the size of them because they were just 10 years of age. I mean, that really struck us, the how young they were. So there was the oldest chap there. They called him great-great-granddad, and he was just 33 years of age, and he died when we were there. We don't know how. So it was this extraordinary mad situation we could never have dreamt in our wildest nightmares to be in. But I had to draw, aren't we positive as gardeners? And it was a way of me dealing with it. As they moved us from camp to camp, they unwittingly took me to cloud forests, remote areas of the Darien Gap. And what grows there? Well, there were orchids, Tamsin, everywhere. I mean, just dripping. You couldn't see the trees for the orchids. They were dripping from the trees. And I started to build gardens in captivity as a way of me dealing with the situation. So we used to go on these armed orchid patrols. Our captors hated it, but they just went along with it. And we went, brought back these orchids to the camp. I started to build, you know, Kew Gardens, eat your heart out. There were some fantastic specimens there. And it was a way of me showing them who I was, who we were, you know, into the outdoors.
To prove who you were, I suppose. Mm.
Not CIA or drug runners or drug traffickers, as they accused me and Paul of being. And at the end of it, it came down to money, really, Tamsin, and this is when it got difficult. I think they believe we weren't any of the aforementioned, but they wanted $5 million each, or they'd blow our heads off, basically, to put it bluntly. And me and Paul thought, we're going to die here, because $10 million is not going to appear. And in their fantasy heads, it was, and we knew it wasn't. So we're going to rot here. And it really got bad as the months went on, and their hostility really increased, to be honest. Not to swear or be too morbid, but it was tough. And they were constantly saying, you know, this is your time, you've got a few hours. Hence the garden coming in into my head to sketch into the diary to really keep myself distracted. It was getting tough. And in the end, they just released us with no explanation, really, apart from people still say to this day, you got released because you never stopped talking. And they just got so fed up. But there's no explanation, really, even of who they were. But they were quite a well-organized, well-armed group. Every one of them, except a couple of toddlers that we saw. Toddlers, Tamsin. My goodness me. A toddler with a grenade. I've never seen that before. And they were so well armed and well stocked with food. And it was quite extraordinary, the experience. But I and Paul are the luckiest couple to be alive, because I tell you, the chances of something going wrong were so high. Malaria, a broken leg, getting shot, obviously, trying to escape and not succeed. I mean, the things that could have gone wrong were countless. But we just, with a positive horticultural attitude, it saved me. The orchids saved my life.
Yeah. I mean, I can't even begin to imagine. I'm too anxious. I would have been the worst companion for you. I think, I don't know, I would have been a total liability. So it's lovely that you were obviously with someone that worked well with you, I take it.
It did. And he's more of an introvert, as you'll be gathering now. And, you know, I'm slightly the opposite to that, a bit more an extrovert, I think. And you combine the two things. It's this neutralization of things. So when he was quite positive and I was down, we neutralized each other to a really good, thought-provoking, good decision-making mentality. And when I was up or down, he was the opposite. And that met us, it neutralized both the good and the bad to just this neutral, let's be calm and think about things. Any other person I would have been with, well, they're far too sensible to have gone anyway with me, to be honest. But anyone else, it wouldn't have worked. We would have probably ended up being shot because Paul had that very pragmatic, let's think and focus. There was Tom and his orchid hunting and lots of talking and so on. And that balance was critical. We saved each other's lives.
So were you together all the time? They didn't divide you?
They attempted to divide us up. They attempted to send one of us home and trick us into thinking that, because they knew that we didn't know each other. Me and Paul, I knew his surname when we were on our hands and knees and an M16 stuck to our heads when we were initially kidnapped in the ambush, and I saw his passport. I knew his surname then. People think we knew each other since school. We just met a few weeks earlier, as you do when you're backpacking. I just met him, and they knew that. Because we told them, they knew it. So they were trying to trick us. Like, Paul actually told us that he thinks this of you and Paul, but me and Paul knew they were lying. And they were trying to trick us, one of us, to go back home at that stage to get 3 million quid in a suitcase. And we knew the person that was left behind would die. Mm. It was a fact, because $3 million isn't. And we thought, there's no way, we're in it together. We both die here, or we both get out. We're in this together. But they tried so many bizarre tactics, and I'm not a hostage taking expert, nor is Paul, but we knew they had our passports still, Tamsin. They had our health passports, you know, where you get a yellow fever jab and that kind of thing, had our cameras, all the evidence that they'd taken us, they still had in their rucksacks. So we knew that they weren't talking or couldn't talk because of the geography of the place to the outside world. So they were just waited. They waited for 3/4 of a year until this money was miraculously going to appear. And we knew it wasn't, and we therefore assumed, right, you'll just be shot for it. That was the general assumption towards the end, until miraculously the day we were released. But it was extraordinary, and I often think back to it, obviously now talking about it, and just think, you know, so many positive things have come out of it, but oh boy, you're really, really lucky to have survived that.
How much of your time was spent thinking about home and thinking about your family, thinking, crikey, you know, my mother, what does she know where I am? I mean, how did that play out?
Oh, goodness me. Again, it shivers down my spine. There's a lot of that this afternoon, thinking about it. I very rarely ask this. It was tough. We had to mentally block it out because it made you weaker, as it would. It makes you emotional. We had to cut that out. We had to show our captors. They tried all sorts. You know, we've heard your granny's been horribly involved in a car accident and has died. You know, they tried all sorts of things to get. It was tough. We knew it was rubbish. But it plays in your mind. And they tried everything. Do you miss your parents? No, actually, I hate my parents. I used to say, sorry? And it's obviously completely inaccurate, but you're giving them nothing. And it was a tactic that we sort of employed ourselves, but it's amazing. I'm just a gardener, but in that situation, how life preservation takes over. You are, your body, your mind, your soul is trying to extend your life by doing things that you can't, even the things you're saying, you're just saying things to preserve your life that you could hardly, I didn't know what those words even meant that I was saying to our captors. It's extraordinary how powerful the mind is to make sure you'll try and survive another day. And when you're asleep, though, Tamsin, oh, that's tough to control your dreams.
Yeah.
And you'd often, if you're suppressing it during the day, to really answer your question, wow, at night it comes out 4 or 5 times as strong. Thoughts of granny in the rose garden here, and you could smell the roses in your dreams. And it was inevitable that was going to happen. You'd wake up you'd try not to cry too much, but it was tough to block out. And when you're obviously asleep, well, nigh impossible. But it was a tactic just to harden yourselves up, and it proved very, very effective not to show any weakness. Can I also stress to you that there was no English. They didn't speak English, didn't read or write. They hadn't the ability to read or write. So my Spanish was okay. Paul was a bit sort of Manuel from 40 Towers, to be honest with you. It was all a bit basic. So trying to get our points across of who we were, we had to diligently make sure we had the right tense. We weren't mentioning financial sums of any sort. They always wanted to know what all our things were worth. he had to just be absolutely lucidly focused, or it could cost your life. And I've never had to think like that. And it really was. Every minute was, every second for 10 months on edge survive.
But do you, I mean, as gardeners, we're pretty tough, aren't we? I mean, you and I are used to being cold, wet, you know, knackered, whatever. Do you think, again, that got you through? Because, you know, your work is physical. If it was someone that had worked in an office, I mean, you know, it would have been a lot harder, wouldn't it, from that point of view?
You're absolutely right. That mental and physical strength that we have as gardeners, whatever role you've got as a gardener, is the mindset, isn't there? The weather with sleet hitting you and hail hitting the side of your head at whatever miles an hour you're weeding out your bindweed or pruning a rose or repairing a wall. You are absolutely right. And I'm so thankful for Granny's attitude at the age of 3 when she said, Tom, get your hands dirty, learn from your mistakes. If you lose plants, you're not learning anything. Off you go. And I'm just self-taught. I've no botanical training as such, nor had she. And that attitude and her stubbornness in whatever weather to garden until she was just 4 weeks short of 96.
Wow.
You're absolutely right. I haven't often seen it as that actually in Colombia. I haven't sort of seen it at that angle, but you're absolutely right. From that viewpoint was another reason why I survived. Paul is he spent most of his time as a bank clerk. He is an office chap. However, he's a mountaineer. There aren't many bankers that are mountaineers.
No.
And mountaineers are, he's quite a thin chap and more susceptible to various things in the Darien Gap, whether it was worms burrowing into his skin or fevers and so on, because I had a bit more sort of flesh on me and, you know, physically too with all the gardening work. But his mindset was exceptional. Mountaineers are an extraordinary breed, extraordinary race of people, and that really helped him. He's so calm and focused under pressure because of his life-threatening sort of situations he puts himself into with all his mountain climbing.
So on a practical point of view, so things like, could you clean your teeth? I mean, I know this is a really stupid question, but what did you have things like that? Or were you in the same clothes for 9 months?
It's not a stupid question at all. It's actually a really good one that no one ever asks. But brushing your teeth. I mean, we ran out of Colgate Fresh quite a lot. And they used to supply us with Colgate. If they said we didn't brush our teeth, they would execute us. I still don't really understand. It was bizarre. However, what I will say, not to be too graphic, brushing your teeth around the world has been brilliant. In the Darien Gap, brushing your teeth is hazardous. The little bristles, quite a sharp brush that I had that was knackered as well after months of being used, just would gently titivate, just gently brush through your gums. You know, you miss a tooth, you get a bit of a gum, a little scratch. In this country, no problem at all. Your gums feel sore for 2 seconds. In there, you've got a mouthful of pus in 2.5 hours. The infection from just a scratch from a little brush, a stiff brush, a little bit of a brush from your toothbrush, and you've just got to watch everything. And flossing was out. I mean, you run out of floss pretty quickly, to be honest with you, because you just misplace a floss. It's easy to do. You know, get a bit of food and draw a bit of blood between your teeth. You've got an infection in less than 2 hours. You've really got to watch yourself. But they made us brush our teeth or they would blow our heads off. They were so hygienic, yet they wanted to kill you. I can't make sense of most of it. It was extraordinary. And when we were threatened with execution because I was a bit late brushing my teeth, this guy tapped me on the shoulder with an M16 with rocket launcher attachment. And I was thinking, what's better, not brush your teeth or be blown up by a flaming rocket launcher attached M16? I mean, the contrast in mentality between the two of us and them, it was extraordinary, Tamsin. Absolutely extraordinary.
Good Lord. I can't believe someone hasn't tapped you up to be in a movie or something about it. It's quite a remarkable story.
I don't think they'd believe a word of it. I mean, the whole thing. What I didn't mention at the end, we did get released. They said get lost, and we did. We had to come back for directions 5 days later. We got lost in the swamp. Honestly true. So back up the hill we went, and they saw us, our captors. They were on there. Needs praying for us to go. They didn't want to see us ever again. And they then said, here's some money. They were paying for us to go. Isn't it the other way around? Aren't you supposed to pay them? And they just, Tom, please, we hate orchids. We hate you. please go. Honestly.
That's incredible. Did you bring any orchids back or not?
This was the thing. In short, no. Because actually, legally speaking, I hadn't got a permit to collect anything because it wasn't really supposed to be. It was just an expedition to cross the Darien Gap over, 2 weeks. So I hadn't got a permit. And nowadays, orchids are so difficult to bring back. But I collected quite a few. And I moved as I was building the gardens and the nomadic lifestyle, as I said, that we lived in, we were part of, meant that I could move the orchids from camp to camp. But in the end, they got so fed up with me, and one night stood on them and poured petrol all over them. And,
Are you joking?
It was a test. They were testing me, and I like on the inside, I was absolutely in bits, thinking that could have been the orchid for Granny. But on the outside, I was like, I don't like orchids. I hate flowers, and they couldn't react to it. If you gave them that positive energy, they just couldn't deal with it, and it was a tactic. We can, however painful it was, just keep smiling. That sort of stiff upper lip thing is so good in that situation.
My goodness. I mean, as my family have been at our home for 5 generations and yours has been a lot longer, and there's this incredible connection to the place because of the past and who's been there. And you feel that you can't be the one to let the side down, don't you? It's a responsibility. But did you also find when you were there that you said you could smell the roses? We're very fortunate to have those such firm memories of a place, aren't we? Like, you feel like you belong there. Do you think that made it worse or better?
It's a difficult one. I think during captivity, to pick an answer, it would be worse. I think prior to that, I was away for 3 years in total, albeit slightly extended. It was supposed to be 2 years. And the 2 years that I was away, Australia and Southeast Asia, that I was studying and collecting in some cases plants, with an RHS grant actually in Tasmania for some eucalyptus, thinking of home all the time. And the minute I left Virtue, and it just proved to me that my taproot is firmly underneath the front lawn here at Lullingston. And that sense of place and history is magnified when you're bored, because you miss it so much, but you appreciate for all the lovely places that you travel. Tamsin, the Philippines was amazing. Australia, wonderful. No place like home. And in particular, in my case, I'm sure with yours too, a real craving for it. And it gives you a real perspective on the projects you might be able to do when you return. But in Colombia, yes, of course I was feeling that, but I had to, it became a nightmare to try and block it out. It's the opposite of what your normal reaction would be. Think of home and think of Granny and the cream teas and cupcakes she used to make with cream and strawberry centres. No. Granny's not there and I'm here. Cut it off. Oh, that's hard. It's hard. But it worked. It made you harder. It really reduced the softness in your thinking. And, it had to be applied for 10 months. It had to be.
So when you eventually flung the door open and arrived home, what was the response? Were they weren't cross with you, I take it.
The family.
Most people thought I was... No, everyone was just obviously just so relieved to see me back. I mean, that sounds an understatement, but most people thought I was dead. Dad had decided, my sister, and I've got to say, Granny, she thought that was your lot. I'd been executed or was eaten by something or lost and died. Only my mum had that sliver of hope left, a maternal instinct that I was still alive. And only just because we got home for the 21st of December, just before Christmas. So all the relations, as it coincidentally turned out, were coming back, sort of our turn to host them. And they had to get an extra plate, an extra set of dinner plates and everything else, and cutlery for Tom. It was literally, we appeared without the media, because it was quite well known, the story at the time. Without that, no one had known we'd even come back. We literally just appeared. And what really summed it up for me, to really answer your question, was had my vigil in July. Paul had his memorial service already.
No.
His parents had decided, oh, it's heavy duty. And mine was coming up in the new year. Mum was going to let the year ride out, 10 more days of it, and then have to make a decision. The Foreign Office said what they said. Look, there's no ransom. they vanished. I'm afraid you'll probably never see the body of his son again. So that in the background, as I walked in Lullington, the church here is on the left. It's a parish church. The priest was setting up for the carol service, who I'd never met. We'd been away 3 years, but obviously he knew all about me and was preparing for my service, my memorial service in a few days. No date set, but was preparing for it with a person he hadn't met. Walked into the church. He was arranging the candles at the altar. And I just, for a little time to myself, sit on one of the pews and just thank a few people, including the great man himself, that I'm not dead. Yeah. Not particularly religious, but it's amazing how you draw on things after that situation.
I'm not surprised.
I didn't see that. Absolutely. I didn't see the priest doing his candles and turning around. He turned around to see me and he went, "Oh, you look a bit like that guy." He collapsed, candles on the floor, he fainted. And Mum walked in a rush and said, "Oh, no, sorry, Retzer." And by this stage, he was all over the floor. "I forgot to tell you that Tom's not dead." I mean, that summarised the whole thing. And he couldn't deal with it. And he looked at me and he hadn't met me before, but from the images he'd seen or from just the look of a person, he said, "Are you Tom?" And it was all too much. Candles went all over the altar. He collapsed. He fainted. And that to me summed up. I mean, if he was like that, wow, people thought I was dead. And it was then beginning to trickle through the information about what really happened. And Mum flew out to Colombia to try and find us. Seriously took her life into her own hands. Paul's dad flew to Panama. Parents that had never met before had only met by two foolhardy youngsters going into Darien Gap. I mean, honestly, Tamsin, best Christmas ever. Isn't Santa great?
Yeah, I think so. You deserved a stocking full of goodies. My goodness. I'm exhausted listening to the story. And then you say to your family, I take it, "I'm going to create a world garden," a few years later. Did they just think, "Oh, here we go"? Or did they think it was a great idea?
I think Dad was the first bit. I think Mum was the second. Dad was like, "Right, this harebrained idea. Okay, right." So it's a cold valley in Kent. We get very cold temperatures here, Tamsin, and you want to grow plants from around the world. Well, he was a forester by nature, and he sort of summarised it by just saying, "Tom, this really is complete and utterly barking." And then looked at me and went, "Yeah, it'll work. It'll be all right." And he wasn't too sure to start with, but bless him, he died 3 years. 3 years ago now since he passed away. He'd be looking down now going, "Yeah, okay, I actually was partly wrong. It's looking really, really good." And he'll be really chuffed. And Mum, as ever, neutral as ever and as positive as ever too, just thought, "Well, if Tom thinks it's going to work, it will be okay." So, and reaping the rewards of that now. But yes, there was quite a gap between starting it. People wonder, well, you came back in 2000, 2001. The garden didn't open until 4.5 years later. You know, what were you doing in between? But it was just preparing the site and getting everything in place to try and develop a garden for opening in March 2005.
So do you think that having had this experience, that it's made you braver? You know, that you think, well, if it doesn't work, it doesn't work, but I'm going to do it. I'm alive, at least. I mean, do you think?
You do. You do see things so different. I mean, the obvious thing is not going back to the Darien Gap. Well, I should hope so, Tom, you'd be thinking. But you do see things so differently. And then the classic thing of just going for it in life and being positive. And obviously, if you get, or people always get down about things, so of course, but the general attitude of what you give out, you get back, Tamsin. And that's been absolutely magnified by that experience in Colombia. And it stood me in fantastic stead for all the challenges of developing, well, the estate as a whole, but in particular the garden, which of course then keeps the roof on the main house quite literally. So yes, I don't regret a minute of it. I wouldn't take back a second of it, even on the dark, dark, hellish days in the Darien Gap. In hindsight, not a minute of it will I take back.
Yeah, and it's made you the man you are, hasn't it? It's
changed everything. I mean, botanically, the best friend's about to come round soon tonight. And I left with him initially those few years ago before captivity, and all those things that have come from that experience. Talking to you now, all the things that have come out of it that I couldn't have even dreamt or think could be made up that have come out from that experience in Colombia. The more I think about it, the more your head spins with ecstasy, because it's really, really turned things around.
Yeah.
It's been absolutely excellent.
So if people want to support your garden, can they just send you a huge check? or some plants?
Absolutely.
Yeah. But obviously visiting, you're open. Is it Friday? You better get this right. Go on, you tell me when you're open.
Friday, Saturday, Sundays. Bank holiday Mondays, 12 till 5. And it's Easter, beginning of April to Halloween, the end of October. And we do groups, midweek groups, Monday to, say, Wednesday or Thursday time. And basically, the supportive thing that people could do, which should be brilliant, is just coming along to see us.
Yeah.
I think plant donations would be great, but I think at this stage there are too many plants in the garden at the moment.
Yeah. You know,
just coming along to visit us would be great.
Yeah, I always say to people, oh, we've run out of room for plants, and they can't believe it, but I think you really have. So I think that's safe to say. Well, I shall definitely try and make the effort to come and see you. And it's been, well, I mean, honestly, fascinating talking to you. And I know it's 20 years ago, but the story doesn't get dull, does it?
It's so vivid talking about it. I still can't believe it was me in the Darien Gap. I cannot believe I was actually there. So, yeah, onwards and upwards.
Good. Well, lovely to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks, Tamsin. Pleasure.
What a remarkable man to come through it and create something so beautiful as the World Garden as a result. So I hope you've enjoyed the podcast today. And until next time, stay put at home and enjoy your garden. Happy gardening.